Welcome back to the Wipeout Podcast. My name is Fernandez, and each and every episode, my goal is to bring you learnings and teachings in movement and mindset so we can live stronger, more fulfilled lives. And this episode is a conversation with Tyson Venables. Tyson is a meditation teacher and mentor from Byron Bay, Australia, and also founder of Flow States Collective, helping people find more flow in their life and reduce friction. And this episode is full of not only a really potent, powerful, moving story from Tyson's personal life, but also really practical tools for how to practice and implement meditation into your life when you have a busy lifestyle, stressful career, family commitments. This is a really no-nonsense podcast that has a lot of great practical tools in it, but also a lot of great theoretical understanding that I think can get glossed over in the meditation space quite a lot. So I think you guys are going to really enjoy this one. There's so much in here, especially if you have aspirations to be a coach of some kind yourself. Without any further ado, please welcome Tyson Venables. What is one meditation myth you wish would just die?
That you need to be a monk to be able to do it, and that you need, or that you have to sit still to do it. There's so many. the biggest one probably I would say is that you have to stop your thoughts.
This is a very common thing that I hear and have heard, and have heard different people's opinions on it. Why do you feel that's a myth, and what do you think is the most destructive thing about that myth?
Your thoughts are always going to be there. And if we try and stop them, and especially with people who are either new to meditation or like aren't guided by a teacher, that they don't realize that the thoughts are okay. The thoughts are always going to come. They're always going to be there. It's just then being able to actually like acknowledge them and move through it and stick with the meditation or the technique that you're particularly teaching. If we're constantly trying to avoid the thoughts and we're pushing them away, we end up becoming so agitated in that meditation, in that practice, that then we're taking away from the beautiful potency of what could potentially be, of allowing it to happen as it happens and then just experiencing it as that experience occurs, and then whatever transpires from that. And our thoughts in meditation do have a great potency for us when we open our eyes, and if we can actually then, once we've opened our eyes and we work out, okay, this is what's happening in my meditation, whether it's through a journaling practice or chatting with a teacher, and these are these thoughts that continue to come up in my meditation, how do I then best navigate that? It allows us then to kind of actually, our mind's telling us what we need to work on, or how we need to work on it. So it's like we're pushing them aside and we keep pushing them aside. Then when do you actually start to do the work that your mind is trying to tell you? You know, so it's kind of like we're trying to get around these thoughts, and like this is why we sit in meditation. And I guess sometimes with that is a confronting piece for some people too, and that's fine. Like thoughts can be confronting. And again, I keep mentioning it's like having a meditation teacher is like having a personal trainer or someone in your life or a pastor or someone in your life that you go to for advice. It's the same thing. Like when you're working with the mind, you need to have someone who's going to be able to guide you. It's like, this is the stuff that keeps coming up. Okay, well, what is happening here? And so that's why I kind of keep coming back to that, because once you have a meditation teacher that's looking after you, or helping you, not looking after you, but guiding you, things begin to kind of really just flow a little bit easier in meditation, I feel anyway.
I couldn't agree more. I've never had a meditation teacher personally, but I think all of these incredibly nuanced, complex, frustrating thought patterns and loops that, you know, I've been stuck in the past, to have someone who's not inside my own head come and just be like, provide some outside context, and someone who's walked that path before in every area of my life, man, it's always something that I have been like, fuck, why didn't I do that earlier? And I know this is what you do now as a meditation teacher as well, but that's definitely not always what you did. You just had a CrossFit background in the beginning, and I'd love for you to take me on that journey. How did you, where did you start from, and how did you wind up doing what you're doing now?
Oh man, that's been a journey. The abridged version, like, so I started in the gym when I was 15. I was playing reps rugby league for North Sydney Bears, and then into the Sydney Roosters, and then finished school, became a PT around 18, 19, and I was working in a Fitness First at the time, and one of the senior coaches was poaching my clients. So I went broke pretty quickly there, and then went traveling, and while I was traveling, before I went traveling, actually I finished my carpentry apprenticeship, and then went traveling and started over in Canada, fell off a roof,
Shit.
and well, it was an icy roof one day. I fell off a roof 5.5 meters and fully landed on concrete, and my right leg got caught in the ladder, and the ladder was sliding, so my left leg took all the weight
Oh.
and drove my heel up through my tib fib and split the syndesmosis membrane, which is the membrane that holds the two leg bones together to stop from kind of
Jesus.
spreading apart. Split it all the way up to the knee. So that was
Fucking
that
hell.
was a massive time. So I spent 18 months off work, 11 months on crutches. Like, when you think about the typical person who breaks their leg, it's about 6 or 7 weeks. I was 11 months on crutches. So in that time, like, I was in Canada anyway, so I was partying quite a lot, and the partying intensified, obviously,
Yeah.
because I'd at that during that time, I was on 90% of my wage on workers' comp. So I was actually earning like more than any person, most people in a snow town, and doing sweet FA. So I
Yeah.
was partying a lot, and that led to a really big mental health decline, because obviously not being at work, not being around people, pain, access to pain medication. I tried to commit suicide. Obviously, waking up 3 days later, I was able to realize that, okay, you've been given a chance here, and marched myself down to the hospital and told them what had gone on. So then that series of events kind of led me to a doctor. My dad's got bipolar and manic depression, so it's been a big thing in my life that I wasn't going to end up on medication. So I said to the doctor, I'm not going on meds for a long time. He goes, no, it's fine. If you don't want to go on meds for a long time, you need to do meditation and really clean up your diet, whether that's drinking alcohol, eating properly. So within a couple of weeks, like, I was on antidepressants for a couple of, I was on antidepressants for a few months, but like, the meditation for me at that point in time was purely like app based. So it was like Headspace and stuff like that, and
Right.
just do guided mindfulness meditation and stuff. And it was helping me. And then also then the diet side of things. So it started to bring me back to that point where I was that 18 to 19-year-old PT, actually really frothing on health and fitness. And I was starting to see these kind of tangible results.
Yeah, wow.
But then I was still getting dragged back into that party scene. So one day I was just like, I had another party episode, and I thought like I was having a heart attack. And then the next day I just literally ripped the bungee cord, the eject cord, and booked a plane flight home and left all of my belongings and everything in Canada and just came home and
Wow.
never went back. So that then put me back onto going back into PT. And so with PT, like, that's ticked away. So it's been like 18 or 19 years now. And then up until about 8 or 9 years ago, I wanted to be a yoga teacher. That was because my mental health background, I wanted to start to incorporate this more holistic way of helping people, and particularly men, and going on to men's health and fitness retreats and being able to offer surfing, yoga, and fitness is like my three passions that I really like. So that kind of began to lead me down this road. And then I got taught my current meditation practice by a teacher, and it changed my life again. It's a mantra-based meditation, being meditation. So it's kind of being is the soul kind of all-encompassing foundation of how we exist. We're human beings. So when we're actually not doing, we're human beings. So it allowed me to actually come back into that being, and rather than running around being an absolute freak, I come back to being. I was able to see life for what it was. And then that's now what's led me down to where we are today, is like what meditation is my primary offering as my foundation of my offering to people who I work with. And then we layer on personal training if they want that, or some sort of life sort of coaching. Because what I found in my 19 years of PT is that people will get to a certain point with their mindset, or there's like certain programs that are playing out within their mind, that they'll get to a certain point with their training. Even athletes, you know, like they'll get to a certain point and it's like they struggle to crack through to that next level. It's because that 1% of the mind is kind of holding them back. So when we're able to really get in control of the mind and actually harness its like potential and its power, it actually really opens up life, and what is essentially we find flow in all sorts of all avenues of life. So that's been my journey to here where I am now.
Dude, what a story. And I really appreciate you just opening up and sharing really vulnerably like that, dude. That's an incredible story, man. That severity of the breaking of the leg, dude, is hectic. I've never heard anyone on crutches for that long.
Yeah, four operations, so it was pretty fun. Oh, my God.
Fucking hell. What was it like for you coming back? You just got on that flight from Canada back home, just after having all of these hectic experiences. You're back into a old, you know, in some ways familiar, but in some ways very foreign part of your life. What was the transition point for you like that, to come back home and then to start to pick up the pieces and get back into something, some semblance of a normal life? What was that transition like?
Oh man, this is a great question. I got kicked out. So I got home, and cause I was still partying, when I left, and I was like, cause I was DJing. So I saw you do some DJing gigs the other day. I was actually, my DJ name is DJ Crutch. So I began DJing when I was actually still on crutches in the bars and clubs in Canada. And so I was getting paid to DJ on crutches, party, like people would want to party with you, so you'd be partying. And so I really didn't learn my lesson from my first stint. And so at that point in time when I decided to leave Canada, I was probably almost at my peak of drug taking.
Yeah.
So when I pulled the pin, I came home and it was cold turkey. And I was the worst human to be around. And so I was living with my mom and her new husband at the time, and I got kicked out of there within 2 days of being back. She's like, you're not welcome back here, don't come back. And then so I went to my dad's, same thing happened there, about a week. And then I went to my brother's place, and after a huge Royal Rumble of a UFC bout between the two of us and me choking him out, I then ended up at a mate's house in one of the suburbs nearby. And thankfully he took me in, Kane Feeney, if you're listening, thank you so much. And yeah, so he was a dude who I'd played football with at the Roosters, and he was living with his sister. So I lived with him for a while, and that's when it kind of, that the ship started to really right itself. Still a bit of partying happening, and that was still, but it was a lot clearer. And that's when I began to really see what I actually really wanted to be doing. And yeah, like that's that instance of him throwing me a bone there really helped me out a lot, that's for sure.
Yeah, man, that's That's wild. And I'm kind of, again, my story is very different, but I've also experienced times where my friends have kind of come to my aid where it's felt like I haven't really had anybody else. And those friendships are fucking irreplaceable, man. It's really, really, it's something beautiful. So you're starting to get into PT now. When was the first inkling that you started to come up against when you started to find that maybe just the physical training stuff wasn't enough for these clients to get the kind of progress that they wanted? Or what made you start to think that there needed to be something more than just what you were doing in the gym with them?
Yeah, that's a good question. Early on when I started, it was the, I called it the Thursday evening from hell, because it was back to back to back to back clients of really emotionally draining clients who I'd get home from, and I was emotionally getting involved with their stuff, and I'd come home and I'd be completely drained and just be like, holy shit, what has happened? And so I had started to kind of work, like start to formulate these questions and like, what is occurring? And I'd end up strategically kind of moving these people rather than having everybody on a Thursday. It was like putting them around in different parts of the week so I could actually then get a break. But then that was where I started to kind of seek out extra, like I was then at that point in time, I hadn't learned my technique of and the meditation, but I was sending them to the apps, so like Headspace app, Insight Timer, and stuff like that to get what they could potentially work. And there was one gentleman, like he came to me, he was heavily overweight, like heavily overweight, and his partner of 27 years had just died. And
Jeez.
he was ready to kind of he was ready to just like end it all there. And I was like, no. And I saw a lot of the stuff in him that I've experienced with my dad. So I was like, yeah, there's this kind of, that's where I began to really feel that connection with him. So I ch it changed his life training with me and getting his mental side of things in check, and helping him that way. And he ended up starting to come off his medication because of what we were doing and how he was feeling, and he's like his body changed heaps. Like he was so stoked, he was starting to get like the bifurcation through his bicep and stuff like that. He was able to see the definition and stuff, so that was starting to make him feel good. And then he was doing his regular meditation, and we started seeing extra more and more results. So that was one of the that was probably that client was like the one that really showed me that there's more to just getting in the gym and doing a bunch of sets and weights and then disappearing. And then yeah, I've always kind of then ended up becoming or attracting more of the client that needed that help. Then when I started PTing in Sydney and went in a CrossFit gym in there, and I had a few clients who were the same thing. It was like, let's get you meditating, let's get you that kind of stuff sorted out, because this stuff's kind of holding you back. And then either their business really started to progress, or like family life really began to kind of take over and take charge. And yeah, it was like, okay, now I need the tools to be able to like help these people a lot more. And you weren't really ethereal then. You had a nice like lovely,
The Jesus
lovely.
glow
Sorry,
coming through from
the
the window
Jesus
up there.
glow came through. I
I've
was like, "Oh,
mistimed
what am I
the
talking
so I didn't mean to interrupt you there. I just had the sun coming through.
about?" No,
Yeah,
good.
this is a story that I hear not often enough, but someone's in the gym, they're doing something, they're trying to make change in their life, they're struggling to stick to the things that they know they need to do, but then something like meditation comes along or some kind of internal work and it turns things around for them and they make all these changes and they're beautiful stories. But this might be a slightly strange question, but like, what is, to your understanding, going on when that happens? What is it about meditation itself, the act of sitting down, observing your thoughts with very low skill in the meditation? What is it about that that actually translates to so much change in someone's ability to direct their life in a better direction?
Yeah, that's cool. That's what I like to think about. I'm going to show my age here, and some people might be able to relate to it, and some might not. But I like to relate to meditation as the reordering of fragmented information and stuff within the mind. You know, so we get so caught up in the doing of like all the day. Daily tasks and then the weekly tasks and the monthly tasks. And then we get so kind of fragmented in our mind that by the end of the week, we're like, we don't know what the hell's been going on. So back in the day when computers first came out, if your computer started like slowing down, you'd run a defragmentation kind of app that would defrag the computer, and you could sit there. I'd sit there and watch this thing kind of defrag, and you could see it like slotting the packets of data of the computer back into place where it needed to go. And then all of a sudden, your computer was running smoothly again. And that's the analogy that I like to use for what meditation is. It allows you to then defrag your mind, whether that's like actually getting clarity on a certain thing that you've been pondering for quite a while, or whether it just puts it away in a place where it needs to be. So when you have people begin to start to meditate, they're able to then access deeper parts of their mind because there's less stuff just kind of whirling around up in there, and that they then have more clarity. And that's the beautiful thing, because it's like when you start to be able to just, it's not getting rid of it. It's just putting it in a place where it's sorted. You're just creating these little buckets in your mind. All right, kids are over here, partners here, like finances here, shopping list is back here. It's all kind of, it's compartmentalized, and it's putting it all back in place. So then when you do need to access it, all that information's there, rather than just like, what was I thinking about with this the other day? Is like, and then life is able to then find that flow, because you're like, okay, cool, that's that decision that I need to make on that. All right, cool, put that away. And then you can then essentially, it takes people from a reactive state into a responsive state. And that's the big thing. It's like we then can then begin to respond to our life, our surroundings, rather than going and reacting to certain situations and like, oh shit, I've got to get the kids from school, blah blah blah, I've got to do this. Like that's kind of happens. And that's the same thing with training. You can then start to really work out, and with training wise, I don't know whether I'll ask you the question as well. It's like training wise, you then are actually able to then listen to your body and go, rather than listen to your body, rather than trying to keep pushing through something, or there's a blockage there, or your body's telling you you're not really sitting properly in space, but your mind is just overthinking it because you've got to get through your set of 10 squats or whatever it is. It's like, no, like let's take the time to correct it and we'll move through it. So it makes you more aware, and it heightens your awareness to surroundings. And yeah, because you're teaching people to do great things with their bodies, like, do you feel that like that greater sense of awareness really helps?
I mean, meditation is not a tool that I use with my clients, but what I do find is that I will come across people that have better body awareness than others by virtue of all different kinds of things, whether that's experience, training, or I'm actually working with a client right now who has done like less physical work, but has done a lot of internal work and kind of spiritual work on herself and a kind of similar, we met through a similar kind of organization that I was doing work through. And I noticed parts of her had some narratives around, I'm not good with my body. I don't have a connection with my body. And that's why she came to me in the beginning. She wanted to feel strong and more connected to her body, more in her body. But what I started to reinforce to her was, no, you actually do have you have great body awareness. She has great ability to feel into where her body is in space and how something is feeling in her body. If it's kind of a good pain or maybe some pain that we want to work around or find another solution to. And that is directly because of her work on her own awareness in her body and in herself. And so I definitely find that that there is real physical transfer to that. And the other thing that was coming up when you were speaking as well is this kind of mental compartmentalization skill that you're talking about that comes as just one of the skills from meditation. I think so much of the way that we live our life is an avoidance of our own thoughts. There's so many, whether it's social media apps, all of the things, you know, gambling, drugs, alcohol, Netflix, any kind of distraction that is just taking away us away from being in relationship with our own thoughts. And I think that's why practices like meditation can be so confronting, because all of a sudden there's nothing else to distract you. And you are just confronted with whatever is right there, the mirror of your own mind in all of its different permutations, not just in the ones that you kind of think about when you're making coffee or having lunch with your friends. It's like you and your own thoughts, you reflecting on your actions, you reflecting on the state of the life that you've created for yourself. And if you're not practiced, or if you're only used to being in existence when you're fucking hyper caffeinated and hyper stimulated and always distracted, and then that stops for a second, that's fucking scary. And fair enough, because there's a lot of anyone that's kind of done that deep dive into their mind is being like, oh man, there's some shit down here. And a lot of products that do really well are really good at taking people away from that, because that's a scary place and there's demand for that. So I think that I'm really seeing how just being in relationship with your own thoughts, and when something comes up that's anger-based, fear-based, you know, scarcity-based, trauma-based, and you just at least have more familiarity with dealing with that. You know, it's just a thought, you know, it's just an emotion, and it doesn't necessarily control you. It doesn't even necessarily mean anything or mean that you have to do something. Just that in and of itself is such a powerful thing to be able to practice.
Absolutely. And yeah, that mindfulness skill, it's like, and mindfully actually being able to, just to piggyback onto that, is like acknowledge the thought or the emotion that's attached to it. Because then it's like, what is, I'm thinking a lot about the fear, like fear of death, like, or I'm anxious because of X, Y, Z. So it's then we can, rather than kind of being confronted, like, and holy shit, like this is all coming up at us, it's like, if we can put a name to the emotion, and we've really learned this at, like, with our 2.5-year-old, it's like, and any parent, like when you chat to your children and you try and get them to articulate how they're feeling, it's like, I'm feeling sad because of this. Okay, cool. So let's try and now work on fixing that for you. Or I'm like, our little one, he gets anxious around big cars and trucks, and that's fair enough. He's 2.5. He's like he's not even a meter tall. And like, you've got these huge metal missiles coming down the road at you. Like, so he's like, I'm anxious. Smart kid. Like, he's like, yeah, it's like daddy, like river anxious crossing a road. I'm like, that's fine, mate. Like, he's great because he's anxious. He doesn't really want to. So when we can really begin to know and actually acknowledge the emotion or what is being tied to those thought patterns, then we can then begin to unpack it. We're able to go, all right, cool. I get anxious going for a swim because there could be sharks. Okay, so what could we potentially do to like move through it? Sometimes we don't need, like, sometimes that work doesn't need to be done, and like, it just kind of, that's what it is. Like, or you can push it or move into it and see what it is. And but then also you can then, if you ask someone who's then seeking to create those like solutions for it, you can seek out a therapist or someone like that who can then help you unpack that emotion a little bit more, that can then really guide you through that period. And the meditation, like you said, it's that nice mirror. But it's even when we eyes open experience, when we can look at, rather than having that mirror, that closed mirror, like those closed eye mirror, if you're just noticing your thoughts throughout the day and where they wandered to and what it's whether it's been taking or where the mind's taking you, and bring yourself back to that present moment and just acknowledge that your thoughts are disappearing and come back to where you are right now, that's an eyes open practice, is just bringing yourself back to where you are mindfully and acknowledging the thoughts are taking you away, and being soft and and allowing that to occur and being okay with it. It's like, rather than judging yourself, oh man, I keep getting caught up in my thoughts and I'm so stupid. Like, this is not good. It's like, no, it's okay. Thoughts happen. Just come back. What were you doing in that moment? If it's something that's really pressing, is writing it down is another great way, because it takes it from that kind of subconscious kind of mind and write it down, and then you can sit there and reflect on it and go, yeah, that actually doesn't mean anything to me. Like, what am I worrying about that? Let it go. And then, because then you're writing it down consciously and you're actually putting it out there. Nah, that's no, I don't need to give that any more weight anymore. And that's one thing that I really began to start to do, is write everything down, fill journals full of just absolute dribble when you look back at it.
Yeah, I've done the same. I remember the very first time I heard about journaling was from a friend of mine. I was in a very dark place and I had a chance kind of dinner with him, and he basically told me about the skill of journaling and how powerful it was. And I remember going home from that dinner. It was, got home at like 11 o'clock and I wrote 5,000 words on my laptop straight away. It's like absolute drivel when I read it now. But that was hugely powerful for me at that time. I want to jump around a little bit in the skill of meditation now and start to get practical with some tools. But you mentioned some interesting things about eyes closed and eyes open meditation practices. Something that I certainly notice is that often when meditation comes to mind, it can really look like a thing in my mind. It looks like sitting on a cushion, scented candles around, this holy, beautiful space. And often it can be hard to create that space in one's own life in order to go and do that. Or that feels maybe like a step out of my life to go and do something that's not in my life. It's like, I've got to go do that. Quite foreign, harder to build habits around. What are the different kinds of meditation that you see being applicable for someone who's quite busy or has maybe struggled to stick to a meditation practice in the past?
Yeah, there's a few that are jumping out. I kind of touched on that mindfulness kind of mindful thought. One thing that I used to really practice a lot, and I still do from time to time. So I'll start with that. My meditation practice I see is like the gold. And that's two times a day for 20 minutes. And that practice is designed to be as comfortable, as effortless as possible. So you could go and sit on your bed, you go sit up against the tree, down the beach, wherever you want, and just close your eyes for 20 minutes and be guided by a mantra.
So it's a walk me through what that's like. If someone's not done mantra-based meditation before, walk me through kind of what that looks like, nuts and bolts wise.
Yeah, cool. So essentially you sit down as comfortable as possible, and then in the mind we begin to think the mantra, and the mantra is a mind vehicle. So it takes the mind deeper down. So if you think about, we're in the waves, your thoughts are in the waves kind of thing, and then when you begin to think the mantra is kind of pulling your mind down to those deeper recesses of the ocean. When you look up, if you've ever gone into the ocean, you sink down. Down, you look up and it looks super peaceful because you're laying on the floor. That's that feeling of, and that's the deeper state of consciousness or deeper state of being. So when you access that deeper state of being, that's when unstressing and stuff occurs, and the mind begins to really get a rest, and the body gets a rest as well. So the mantra
is a word or a sentence or a phrase that you repeat over and over out loud in your mind.
Correct. So we give it's onomatopoeic, so it's a Bija mantra. So the practice we teach is from the Vedic lineage. Right. And so Vedic lineage kind of goes through, has a golden thread through most other kind of Buddhist, Taoist meditations. Buddha took some from Vedic and then created his own sort of thing. So with that, it's the meditation that is so onomatopoeic. It's got a vibration, so the vibration just vibrates and resonates in your mind. Transcendental meditation, so it's a form of transcendental meditation. Transcendental meditation uses a mantra as well, so that could be like love or like whatever the teacher's given them. That got trademarked, so essentially that's whatever transcendental meditation teachers teach. That's kind of, they'll give you whatever that mantra is. And then, yeah, so that mantra then, or mantra, is then what you get and is yours, and then you just continue to allow it to vibrate and feel it in the body, because that vibrational energy that the word holds for you is then is what pulls you down a little bit deeper. So in saying that, sometimes with the mantra, your mind will forget it, or you go off with a bunch of thoughts, and then as soon as you think about it's disappeared, you're bringing yourself back to the mantra. So the mantra is like the anchor point that brings the mind back and continues to bring your mind back. So I like to tell my students, it's like when you're in the gym and you do one rep and you're like fatigued, or if you've just walked into a gym and you're trying to do a chin-up and that's all you can get out, and then the next day you come and you do two chin-ups, or the next day you do three chin-ups. That's the same sort of thing, as like the mind goes out, that's one rep. You bring it back to the mantra, go back out, come back to the mantra. So if you, each time you're doing it, you're doing a mind rep. So that's a rep. And then as soon, like then over a course of years, the mind still goes, but it doesn't go as long, and it comes back to the mantra. And then you're able to establish that state of being a lot quicker, and then come back to it. So that is the technique that we teach, is like bringing you back to being. And then, like I said, that's kind of the base foundation. And then with that, then layering on any other kind of type of meditation on top of that, then creates a little bit more potent meditation practice for any of these other mindfulness meditations and stuff like that. Because when you're in that state of being, the rest then kind of just scaffolds and it's like supercharged. So if you wanted to do like a manifestation meditation or some kind of like loving kindness and stuff like that, so those kind of meditations where you're actually doing that become more heightened, because you're actually then in that deeper state of being, which is what deeper consciousness we are and what we've made up of, and then everything else is then being able to be cemented on top of it. So another practice that really works for me is like eyes open, is just like gazing. So whether you're near the beach, or you can get out near something, or on a hill, and you just look, you pick something in the distance or close to you, and you just watch it, and just every time the thoughts come back into your mind and they take you away, just come back to watching what it is. So I used to do it down at the beach and watch like the cargo carriers, like the coal ships just floating by, and just watch the ship just go like across the ocean, and 20, 30 minutes would be gone before you know it, just watching these ships. And each time the thoughts would come, you just come back to the ship. And so it's a nice way of being able to just gaze and just be there. You're being in that moment of just being you and that ship. And the ship can be like, as the eyes open experience of like what a mantra would be.
Interesting. I'm thinking as you're talking, it's similar to many things, from surfing to handstands, that there are many different practices that you can do. There are many different shapes you can make in handstand, many different skills you can do on a surfboard. But part of the challenge is getting someone to the point where I can either stand on their hands or stand on a board. There's a process to get to the point where you're actually doing the thing. And so I can really see how, if you wanted to work or meditate on a particular thing in your life, or people want to do manifestation stuff, loving kindness stuff, or whatever it is, and get some form of outcome, I can already see how kind of the equivalent is just learning to do the first thing, is learning through that mantra-based meditation to pay attention to whatever you're doing. Because if you're trying to meditate and focus on some particular thing or feeling or something like that, but you're not actually, haven't developed the skill of paying attention, that's almost like a prerequisite. And so not only would that make your other practices more powerful, it's also kind of like you need to get to the dance a little bit. If you can't actually spend any time standing, if you can't get up on the board, it's very difficult to learn how to do your snaps, or, you know, whatever the equivalent would be.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the thing, is like, I always think about like guys like Kelly Slater. Like, he's won 11 world titles for a reason, because he's done the reps on his board. But there's also that dude also practices meditation. So that's what's been able to deepen his ability to access those deeper states of what he needs to for his ability to surf at a higher level. So, for everything, it's a practice, and that's why it's called a meditation practice, because we're practicing. And when you go to your gym and you practice your muscle ups, because you're practicing those things, that skill set to hone that skill. Parenting is a practice, because you're always practicing. You're practicing to be a parent, because nobody can actually teach you to be a parent until you're a parent and you're like, ah, this is what happens. So it's like, it's a practice. And a lot of parents get kind of upset because they're like, oh, like I'm failing my children, or this is like occurring and I've got no idea what I'm doing. It's good, because you're a practice. You've the first part of it is you've actually acknowledged that you don't know what you're doing, or you're needing help. And now you can actually get help and get practice on it. And it's the same thing with meditation. It's like, unless you're born enlightened and you're born living in a cave and meditating straight away, it's a practice that's going to have to occur over a certain amount of time. And it's softening. Like, no matter how macho or how masculine you want to be as a man, it's softening into that practice of meditation and allowing it to happen, because then you're not actually becoming a softer man. Like, I'm just going to go the masculine side of things now. It's just like, you're not softening as a man. And that's one myth also. It's like, it doesn't make you softer. It makes you more laser focused on everything. And especially as a masculine man, it makes you more knowing on, like, this is what my role is as a masculine man, as a father, as an athlete, this is where I'm going. So you're not going to get it all at once. There's many levels of it, many levels of the practice. And it's just finding time, finding 2, 5 minutes, 20 minutes, whatever it is that you have in your day. I can guarantee you most people spend more than 5 minutes a day scrolling on Instagram or social media. It's just one of those 20 occasions that people might spend 5 minutes, you know, rather than, like, as soon as you go to scroll, okay, now I'm going to put that down. 2 minutes of meditation. That's beginning. And that 2 minutes might turn into 4 minutes the next day. And then, you know, soon you've got like 20 minutes under your belt and you're noticing that you're not cutting someone off in traffic, or you're blowing up at some, or you're blowing up your kids, or training feels a lot better because your mindset's there, because you're actually like able to be there rather than focusing on everything else that's occurred outside of the gym. And that's the other thing, like, circling back to like my original kind of my journey. I used to use the gym as an escape. Now I train because I actually really want to train and be better than what I was. I used to spend 3, 4 hours a day at the gym because I wasn't wanting to face everything else outside. So that was my way of, and I've trained people. This is my only outlet. I've got to do this. Like, I've got to be here to be like, and because like everything else is shit outside. So and that was another, like, circling back again, as like another red flag for me that I need to start to help people in this way, because like having to escape that to be here is that we're beginning to create a dependency on this being your outlet for that, rather than working with that, then this can actually be something that's really potent for you. So yeah, sorry about circle back.
But no, that's great. I can 100% see that. And, you know, this is the interesting thing about meditation and other things like it as well. The things that we know are good for us, you know, often knowing that intellectually is not enough to motivate somebody to translate to someone doing this regularly. That's been my experience with meditation. I was lucky to have found other things that almost took that place for me personally. But even the things that we know that we are good to do, like meditation or whatever it is, it can be so hard to stick to it. And I think with something that's high skill based, like meditation, especially if they don't have a teacher in the beginning, is the frustration of a lack of perceived progress. And, you know, especially again, if you don't have a teacher, there's no feedback loop in the beginning to be like, was that good? Am I meant to feel better? Was I just getting frustrated because I'm getting distracted? Or what are these thoughts coming up that are confronting? what would you say to somebody, you know, maybe just stick with it would be enough, but what would you say to someone that's kind of feel like they've tried and they just couldn't stick to it or just couldn't get it in some kind of way? I'm sure that's a conversation you kind of have kind of often. So I'm interested to see what you'd say.
Yeah, man, that's a good one. We like to use the thing of gratifying and ungratifying meditations. So it just, rather than using a good and bad as like, oh, that was a bad meditation or that was a good meditation, because then you're sitting, then the nature of human beings, they want to chase the good all the time. They want to chase, and if it's bad, it starts to create a word association with meditation as being bad. So you start to kind of associate your that was a bad meditation, like, oh, couldn't stop, blah, blah, blah. But if you use ungratifying, so it was still a meditation, but it just was ungratifying. Like I was kind of off with, like, I had off with my thoughts. There was too much going on. The kids were yelling. There was a chainsaw started halfway through. Like, it was ungratifying. And then the next day when there's like one that's just like birds are chirping, sun's hitting your face, and you literally just drop straight in, that's a gratifying meditation. And it allows you then to not actually chase these good and bads. You're like gratifying, ungratifying, and you're able to then able to just experience it for what it is. And then we've touched on it before, is the journaling part of it. Whether it's only 2 minutes of like meditation that you've had and it was a ungratifying meditation, write it down. That was ungratifying. And the thing that I found with my early meditation journals, like I had a meditation journal. So it was like after a meditation, I would write in the journal whether it was gratifying, ungratifying, or before I even realized gratifying, ungratifying, I was like, oh, that was terrible, blah, 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 blah. And I fell off the wagon many times, you know, like, because it was like, oh, this isn't working, this doesn't work. And then, but I write down, like, this is kind of, today's meditation was really peaceful, blah, 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 and just leave it there. And then the daily recap journal is another one that really starts to show whether meditation is actually having an effect on your daily life. Mm-hmm. Because at the end of the day, you can start, I like to use some particular journal prompts for beginning and evening, rather than just kind of just scrolling a bunch of random thoughts, is actually using journal prompts to get you to actually decipher what has actually occurred throughout the day or is going to occur. So like at the end of the day, it's like, what did I achieve? What am I proud of? Was there something that I was reactive at? Like, what did I, and is there something that, like, or how could I have better responded in X situation? So then you can write that down, and it's like you might begin to start to see that meditation is having an effect. Because like I touched on before, like if you're a parent and you got a toddler at your feet and you're like, go away, just leave me alone, I'm trying to cook dinner, blah, 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 that might start to turn into inviting the child in to actually help you with dinner rather than trying to shoo them away. Or someone's like, if you're someone who has really bad road rage and then all of a sudden you're just cruising along and someone pulls into your lane, and normally where you're just flipping the bird for cutting you off, that might be a thing that starts to show up, and you're like, and you've written it down, you're like, oh yeah, that person, I didn't react to that situation today. So it's then you start to actually become more mindful of like, this is the stuff that's actually occurring. Because I think a lot of people who meditate or try to meditate, they think that's the meditation is what is the thing that's occurring for you. It's meditation is just the thing that's allowing everything else to occur for you properly and easily. So, you know, like meditation, you're closing your eyes for that moment, whether it's 2, 5, 20 minutes, and you're there. You might not be like overly there, the thoughts are just coming and going, but then the rest of your day seems like it just kind of moves with flow. You might begin to even get like job offerings that you've kind of been pondering on for a long time, and you just they just start to appear, and you're like, what's the common denominator here? What's this thread that's kind of changed? And it's the meditation, it's the way your mindset is starting to kind of rewire, and the energy that you're putting into your day has started to change and snowball. And then that way, then it's like, oh yeah, because I was meditating. Like, I know myself, if I fall off the wagon meditating, and the day just start, like, there's it just grinds, and I get a little bit reactive, or certain things just kind of get compressed and compressed and compressing. Like, fuck, like this, I'm not getting a break from this. And it's like, you haven't meditated today, or you haven't meditated for a couple of days. Okay, let's sit and meditate, and everything then starts to kind of unfurl and come back to it. So it's kind of a long-winded answer there, but I would just really, for people, it's just the coming back to that, the journaling and being kind to yourself, and allow, and just making those mental notes that are how your life is occurring with eyes open, whether it's 2, 5, 20 minute meditations or whatever it is. Just notice the subtle differences that start to occur rep after rep.
That's awesome. I want to come back to that gratifying, ungratifying thing. So I think that's so huge. That's so similar to training as well. You know, when I parallel that to training, there's going to be days where you walk into the gym, you haven't slept well, you ate too much just beforehand, your body's not feeling super primed. Not every session is going to be great. In fact, there will be many sessions that are subpar or even, you know, very ungratifying. But the whole good and bad shift of gratifying, ungratifying, I think really, really helps you divorce from that outcome a little bit more and just see, I'm just in this for the process. This is something I work with clients quite a lot with as well, on just how do you set this up to be a part of your life? So it's a thing that you enjoy. It's a thing that you find generally gratifying, but you also don't fail yourself when you have a bad workout. Because the goal is not to have a good workout. The goal is just to make this a part of your life, because you're going to be in a physical body forever. There's advantages to having that physical body be in less pain and be able to allow you to do the things that you want to do with your body and feel the way that you want to feel when you're doing the things in life you want to do with the people that you love. And given that that's the case, and we don't live in another world where we can just, like, I don't know, jack up to an IV and lie down in virtual reality, you know what I mean? It's like, well, that's a pretty good idea to surrender to the process and find a way to make that sustainable for you. And I really love that gratifying, ungratifying thing as well. Anything that allows you to divorce your own identity as a person. Like, I had a bad workout, it's because I'm unfit or I'm weak, or I felt a bit of an elbow pain, so that's because I'm easily broken. Or it's like, no, that just is a thing that happened in the context of the thing that I'm committed to because I value it. And I think the same thing is, like, we get into these things. I'm a big believer in starting for the wrong reasons. It's much better to do that and then to start to learn to readjust and recalibrate along the way, because you often don't know until you start that they are the wrong reasons. And often that will bring to light the relationship you have with those reasons for wanting to start, for being stressed, for being in a marriage that you don't like, for anything, those thoughts underneath the surface that you want to start to change or get to the bottom of. And that's also what I want to come back to for what you were saying earlier about thoughts that are coming up in meditation that there's space to work on afterwards. If someone's starting to practice meditation and these thoughts are coming up and they're quite confronting, or how do you start to interpret those thoughts afterwards in a kind of debrief with a client?
That's a nice question. For me, I'm going to say triage in a way.
Nice.
We triage the thoughts and triage the what is occurring. And it's the same sort of thing as, like, when you're coaching someone, and whether they've had a bunch of ruptured shoulders and their shoulders barely holding itself together, you triage what you can do with them before you get them on a ring, because, like, that ring is probably, they're not going to have the stability to hold themselves in a dip position, a locked out dip position, or whatever it is.
Yeah.
So it's the same thing with meditation. Obviously with meditation, it brings up different forms of trauma. In saying that, training training can also bring up trauma
yes,
in different
very
people,
true.
especially if they've had social trauma in certain areas, or they've had they've been physically abused or something like that. Even a trainer touching them like showing them some way that can trigger something. So it's as a teacher, as a trainer, is showing us a sensitiveness to the situation, and using your skill set to actually get that triage and go, right, I might actually have to refer, like if it's a full red line and you need to actually refer out, we refer out. I have, and that's why as a meditation teacher and a trainer, I have a plethora of professionals that I can then send someone to go, okay, I think you need to, let's get you in to see. I've got three preferred practitioners who are psychologists. You can choose one that really sits with you. And that's the big thing too, as a trainer, as a coach, not every person you send is going, and if you're sending out, is going to gel with that particular practitioner. So it's actually able to then have a couple of different options, so then you can actually send to that person and go, yeah, I think that will really jam with this person. And then that way, then the client and also the person, the practitioner, are like gelling straight away. And then that is a further benefit to their health and well-being and progression. If there's no refer out, then we kind of look at, okay, cool. Like, what can we achieve today that is going to, and it's the small wins. It's the 1% that eventually turn into that big snowball. So it's like, if someone's completely been triggered by like a complete kind of like unraveling of a relationship and business all at once, and it's all occurred, okay, well, what can we actually change today that's going to help XYZ tomorrow? And then we can look at changing everything else and getting everything else back on board. Because when we try and tackle that big snowball that's rolling down the hill, we're just going to get flattened by it. So it's like we try and get that little snowball turning, you know? So, yeah, triage is definitely a big way of doing it, if we want to use a modern medicine type of way of analogy.
I think that's fucking great, man. And I feel really passionately about this kind of thing, because there's tension here and there's paradoxes hidden here. You know what I mean? When it comes to trauma, when it comes to pain of any physical, emotional kinds, there are cases in which it's required to have a person that's really, really qualified to handle someone going through the most hectic kind of physical pain or the most hectic kind of emotional pain, deep-seated trauma. There is real responsibility there. And I understand the concerns that people have about some more modern holistic practitioners, whatever you want to call it, doing trauma work. The other side of that is that those containers don't necessarily resemble your life very much. And after exiting that container with a trained professional like that, you then have to go back to your day-to-day existence and be in your own mind and be in your own body and relate to the people in your life that you've had in your life for probably since the time that you've went through those things. And there's this whole gaping void that can be filled with so many tools, so much help, so many practices that can help people have a better time in their own experience of being themselves, that there's crossover and there's gray area. And so to hear someone like yourself and like, hey, like you have a PT background, whatever, trainers and meditation teacher, you have a lot of experience, but there's also like, we don't have to compete with each other. It's not like a science versus meditation. And, you know, we're like clashing. It's like, no, man, people need help. And the more that there are systems and organizations and relationships with people and professionals that talk to each other, that co-manage cases together, that is, I believe, the future of a far better model of healthcare than just science and therapy or just experiential and spiritual based practices. I think the combination of the two wisdoms of both of those overarching fields is 100% the future for people just having a way better fucking time. That's my rant on that, but I think that's really important.
No, I agree. And like when you start to even read like a lot of like the Jung psychology and stuff like that, like they a lot of his stuff early work, it was about doing it and like kind of energetic work and stuff like that as well. So it's like there is that like you can't just cut holy and solely just like this is what the book says, this is what we do, and you're not going to acknowledge like the energetic body and the way the energetic body interrelates with everything else. Like this needs to occur. So it's like having the, as a trainer, like if you don't have the, you're not, and I don't have any, like at this point in time, I don't have any interest in trying to be like a spiral person or going down a full psychology route. But I have the tools right now that I can help people with like my holistic lifestyle coaching and everything else that I've done and my own personal lived experience. I can help quite a lot of people. But when it gets to a point where it's like, you know what? I think you're probably better off, or you'll benefit from visiting this person. Come back to me. I think this. I've had that before in my own my PT business, like with this, all of the functional movement stuff and all of the different stuff that I have done, and how to screen people and all that kind of thing. I would do a screening and go, you know what, I think you should go see this exercise physiologist down the road and get a screening and see whether what I'm thinking is correlating to what they think, and get a program from it. They'd go down and see this person, and then they'd come back and go, it's exactly what you said. Like the guy just said, just continue listening to what Tyson said and keep going. But then that then all then allows that there's that non-bias to be taken place. The pe person can then go, oh yeah, cool. The guy that I'm actually being trained by or being taught by has the humility to actually go, yeah, go see this person, come back to me. And as a trainer, as a teacher, it's also putting that ego and that lack mentality, because it comes down to a lack mentality. If you don't want to refer out to someone because you're afraid that that person might take your client, then you're never going to get past that level, because it's like you're always going to be hanging on to your students. It's like a lot of I've noticed like a lot of yoga teachers, they call them, they're my students. Like they're not your students, they're people who will come, they're people who are coming to play pay to come to your yoga class. They're not your students, they're people who are coming to learn from you, and they're learning from like Sharon, who teaches at 5 o'clock on a Friday as well. So she's also te so who, you know what I mean?
100%. That's
So
fucking
it's
hilarious.
like they're people who are coming to learn from you. And at the end of the day, if you're going to hold on as a practitioner or as a trainer, and you're holding on to them for dear life, there's a good chance that those people are eventually going to feel that, and they're going to leave and fly the coop anyway. So I always refer out if I need to, and I know that my knowledge is going to have them come back anyway, but it allows them to have that and be seen. And especially in a trauma situation, it's you'd rather have people looked after.
This is maybe a slightly unexpected tangent, but I think it's so important. And there's also coaches listening to this as well. I know a few like people that are either aspiring to be coaches in the physical or other holistic spaces as well. And I know for me, when I first started doing the PT stuff, like I do a fair bit of work with people that have kinds of pain, joint injuries that haven't really been fixed by lots of other physios and that kind of stuff in the past. And in the beginning, I knew that that was a way that I could help people, but I also had a lot of fear around, oh, but I'm not qualified for that. I want to say that I can help people with this, but I'm not a physio. And now I understand that there's two sides to that imposter syndrome thing. Number one, it's like fucking fair enough, and that's important because I was inexperienced. When you start anything, you're going to be inexperienced. And there's an importance to take that seriously. And I think that underneath everything, it came from both wanting to save my own skin, but also wanting the best outcome for my clients. And number two is I don't think I really realized just how much that it was just a lack of experience that made me think I have to have all the answers. And if I don't have all the answers, people won't work with me. And then I started to get more experience and I started to also get a bit more comfortable in myself as well. I was like, oh, I don't have to have all the answers. And I can just stick to what I do. And eventually what I found was I could just like, for me, I can work with somebody if they can, if I can find a way to get them to move with that pain and expand that pain free range of motion, I will 100% work with that person. And I know I can take that person much further than your average trained physio or ex-phys can, because that's my specialty. And if I can't get that person to move without pain, the last thing I would want to do is try and fuck around and find out. You know what I mean? Let's try this. Let's try this. I work with people in pain, so therefore, let me just, I can fix everything for you. That's also not the way. And this is where I love just like, man, you can just, doesn't have to be on me. If I just speak into that younger version of myself, I'd be like, bro, you can just ask for help. You can just send people to other places. And I think that both inspires confidence in your clients and also allows you to have a way better time. It allowed me to have a way better time anyway, coaching people.
Absolutely, man. And it shows like there's a level of humility, and it shows that it's like you're open to other ideas. And because the other thing is like I've always been someone who loves to learn anything I can get my hands on. So if I'm referring to someone that I actually like, when I was living in Sydney and I was coaching in Sydney, I had a chiro who was a sports chiro in living in Bondi. He was in Bondi, and Dr. Nick, and he's amazing, man. And I would like, even if I knew what I was, I'd refer them to him anyway, because like I'd love getting the feedback from what they would then get from him, because then I was able to learn. Cool. Like they've said this, and then that added on to my skill set. You know, I went through that imposter syndrome, you know, like, especially like I went and did my FMS 1 and 2. So functional movement screenings 1 and 2. And I was the only trainer in the gym, in that course. Everybody else was a doctor, a physiotherapist, or an exercise physiologist. I was the only PT in there, and I held my weight, and I was like, holy shit. Like I can sit here and, but listening to the level of conversation that these people had, I was like, I'm learning via osmosis by listening to the way they're actually now looking at someone's body. And because the way I've always trained people was I just watch people move and go, there's something, have you ever had an issue with your hip, or have you ever had something that's going on? Oh yeah, like I broke my ankle when I was 12, and I just kind of hobbled around for 7 weeks, and then like I had a sore hip, and then I had a sore shoulder, and then all of a sudden my whole like chain broke down. I'm like, well, let's look at this ankle issue. And then you fix the ankle issue, and then everything else, the whole chain fixes up. And that's been my way. Like I just kind of, I always see like the beautiful mind kind of thing playing out. All the, you know, but I just kind of go, I was like, yeah, I think this is what's going on. So, and that's the same thing with being with meditation and stuff as well. It's just like, okay, so this is what's happening, you know, being observant. And that's for like, just for anybody who's listening, and especially young trainers or trainers in general, is being observant. And rather than putting, it's like in any relationship, it's actually observing and being an active listener or active watcher on what your client's giving you, rather than just being wholly and solely dogmatic on what the program is you've written down. It's like, look at the way the person's moving and listen to the way they're actually articulating their words, in whether it's like in a moment of crisis, and go, how can actually this be of what is in my toolkit that actually could be of benefit, rather than trying to actually be dogmatic on the, you're 5 weeks into your program and we have to get this done because this is the way I've written it. And then you get to week 8 and they completely hit the wall, and you've missed this cue on the sore knee that they were telling you, and like that's just blown everything else out. So it's being able to actually, as a coach or as a meditation teacher, is listening to that, and let's take a little moment to collect and see what's going on, and then you there's a good chance you're going to break through that wall once you correct that stuff.
Exactly, man. Like what you're talking about is the reason that I no longer will see people for one-off sessions in the 99% of cases, because my understanding of how change is made in the body, how change is made in any acquiring any skill, is that it is the furthest thing from a linear process to when you start. I have a very rigorous assessment process with everyone that I work with. And even so, I get things wrong in the first 2 weeks, or I find ways to do things better after 3, 4 weeks. And I know that the best way to do that is just being like, cool, fucking strap in. Let's sign up for this process of uncovering what is going on with your body and how best to set things up to get you the results that you want. In my case, with a particular skill, in your or strength skill, in your case with meditation, like that is just a pro. It's a fucking messy process. As much as I try and get calculated and clean cut with it, I'm like, all right, let's just embrace the fact that this is a messy process. There's going to be changing. There's going to be, we're both going to learn. Things will change. Life circumstances will change. And the process that we are signing up for is not a spreadsheet of exercises. The process is, how do we fit the working towards these goals? Whether it's more flow, more peace, a muscle up or handstand push up, whatever that is, feeling better in your body, feeling more powerful and controlled in your body. It's like, that's a process. That's a practice. And so signing up for that process, whatever that entails, rain, hail or shine, I think is, and then also not being afraid to refer out along the way as well, if other things come up, I think is a far more robust process. And in my experience, it's a better outcome for clients as well.
Absolutely. It is. And it's, and your clients benefit from it. Like they'll see results a lot quicker and be a lot happier. And then like you and I both know about the business of it, those people are more likely to then refer others. Cause it's like they've, and the other thing is like just touching on what you said there, it was even like the programming side of things, it's like, yeah, that you get 3 or 4 weeks down the track and you've done your screening and you realize, oh, there's something here that I kind of might have missed, or lifestyles change. People move differently, and then something starts to present itself. So then that needs to shift again. And it's having that kind of pliability in all aspects of helping people that actually then allows people to go get the most out of whatever it is they're doing.
Yeah.
And I'm agreeing with you as well. Like I don't see anyone less than like, I don't see like 1 a week's, cause that's, I don't like that, you know, cause I did it and you end up just kind of beating your head. Like, how was your week? Yeah. I did nothing else other than, So, it's got to be more than 1 a week, because if you actually really want to see results and you're actually serious about it, and all of my business coaches and PT coaches and stuff that I've worked with in the past, they're like, no, that's single weeks are not. And that's the same thing with meditation. Once a week's not going to get you, like, help you. Like, it'll help you a little bit, but it's like, if you really want to enact change, it needs to become a part of your regimen. It's got to be part of what you do. It becomes a part of your life, and it's like becoming like muscle ups become a part of your life, because that is what you're working for. And I know you've spoken to John, and like even it becomes back to your value set, you know, the values that you actually truly value in your life and what your life goals are. And if it means that you want to move and have a superior mindset deep into your 70s, 80s, then that's the stuff that you got to think about now, especially if you're in your 30s, late 20s, early. If you're in your early 20s and you're thinking about this, I'd take my hat off to you, because I wasn't.
Fucking, oh, hell no. Nope.
it's like, that's the thing, you know, when you start to think about this stuff and you go, longevity wise, I can be, and you don't have, this is the thing, I'm going to go on a bit of tangent, but it's like, you don't have, this isn't biohacking. This is just living properly. Like biohacking and all, trying to biohack your way to longevity. If you literally just put simple things in place, like eating well, meditation and moving, your longevity is going to be increased tenfold, by, rather than sleeping like shit, but then trying to take all the adaptogenic mushrooms and stuff to get yourself out of it. Like, that doesn't work. You know, but if you add that stuff on top of what you're already doing, and it's pretty simple to sleep, like once you start to get your everything else in check, I think, I won't go too far, much further down that one.
Like the biohacking of the can of worms, dude. Just as we start to Just as we start to land the plane a little bit, you know, your business is the Flow States Collective, and you know, a big thing that you try and do is help people find more flow in their life. And I'd love just to you to speak on flow a little bit as a concept, because for me, you know, the first books I would read on flow, like that Mihai Csikszentmihalyi book, I was like, wow, this is fascinating. The book called Flow, for anyone listening that hasn't read it. But then I kind of see, like, you know, is this extreme sports, people jumping out of planes and going on crazy heli skiing things, or is this someone meditating, or is this a productive work day? There's all these different aspects to flow. So why is flow something that you've chosen to focus on with people? And maybe why is the absence of that flow a big problem that you see in people's lives?
For us, Flow States Collective, Flow States Retreats, the iterations of it, it's come around from everything, all aspects of our life that we really find flow in. And then with that flow, then everything else kind of comes from that. So like we first originally began as Flow States Retreats, which is yoga, surf and fitness retreats. And that was what really is what still does light us up. And then obviously, and meditation was in there as well. But flow and flow state, so flow state is essentially like your absence of time when you're in something so much that you're non-worrying about time that's going by. Like you can, like you hear about surfers who just, they go out there for like 3 or 4 hours and they're not cognizant of time. They're just on the wave. And when they're on the wave, that's their deepest flow state, because they're just like carving through the wave and they're at one with the wave. And utilizing that and just thinking of like kind of that analogy of life as a wave, it's when flow is like when you're moving with the wave of life. And whatever you're doing, it just feels effortless and with ease. And when you're not, it's kind of like you're grinding against the grain. Or again, to use another surfing kind of analogy, if anyone who has surfed, it's like you're out there surfing and you're just paddling against the current nonstop, that whole surf. And that's not flow. Like you're like, fuck this. Like I want to go in. Like I'm done paddling for half an hour just to stay in the same spot. This is like, and that is essentially like the pretty much the opposite to flow state, because you're just in the, like you're in it. It's constantly drag, it's that drag. So for us, finding flow state, and for us at Flow States, that's what we do. We try and help people find flow state in all aspects of their life and what actually resonates with them. It's not just like you have to do meditation and this is the way you're going to find flow. Meditation's our underpinning. But then like you enjoy horse riding, or you enjoy surfing, or you enjoy poetry, or you enjoy art, or whatever it is that you allows you to access that flow state, then we're going to help you get the tools to do that. Because a lot of people in society spend a lot of time paddling against the current, and it's hard work. So when we can actually find that beautiful long peeling right hander that goes all the way down the beach, and you're just surfing that wave, like, you know, like even yourself, I was just discussing before, like going for a skate along the skate, and you're just kind of like on a nice longboard, and you're just kind of flowing along, and you're feeling it, and you've just got your tunes in, and you're in flow, and you just, nothing else matters. And so when we can find these aspects of life that allow us to access that, then that's when life becomes a lot more freer, and you can then be accepting of anything else that comes in into your field, because nature, God, whatever you want to think of it as, begins to present you these opportunities a lot easier, because you're actually open to more potential. Because when you're moving with flow and you're moving with the current of your life, not someone else's life, and you're moving with the current of your life, nature will go, here's a job that you really wanted. Do you want it? And you're like, actually feels really good, feels charming. Let's go with it. And I'll follow that charm. And then you go with it, and then maybe that job doesn't work out, but you've now learned a new skill set and you're on a new path, and it's taking you from that really shitty job that you were in to something else. And then now you're scaffolding on top of that. So charm, just flow allows charm to present itself, and you can move in different directions with it.
Really beautifully said, man. Those synchronicities that we all experience are, I don't know, I find it kind of beautiful to be mystified by them. But to find more of those and to allow more of those to come in is certainly a very, very beautiful thing to happen. My last question for you is, you know, I really like that you were real about falling off the bandwagon and coming back on and falling off again and getting back on with meditation and all the practices that you do, as we all do. In those times where you fell off the bandwagon and maybe there's parts of you that want to throw it all away, what made you continue and pick it back up that one more time? Why didn't you let it all go like many do?
Yeah, it's a good one. Well, because I've been to the very bottom of the barrel, that's probably been one of the drivers. You know, I've had that huge dark night of the soul, if you want to call it that,
yeah.
Moment. Been on that hero's journey, if you want to call it that. Those moments where I've realized that the work that I've done up until this point is pointless if I don't keep going. You know, if I've always said ever since that point, and some people may have never not had this point yet, you know, may not have, you don't have to attempt suicide, or you don't have to have like that extreme, but if you've had that point where your foundation has been completely shaken, you realize I'm not going back to that. And this stuff is helping me. And so you get back on, and having that softness and having that ability to go, yeah, cool. Like, I fell off the wagon. So be it. Let's move on. You know, I fell off the sobriety wagon a number of times, and I beat myself up because, like, I knew that that was a detriment. But when I fall off the health and wellness wagon, it's fine. You know, like, I'm going to get back on because I know this wagon is the wagon that I'm getting on and going hard on. And again, once that axe gets sharpened and you continue to sharpen the axe, there's no way that's kind of getting like blunted then. So it just kind of reaffirmed for me especially like once it's kind of you dip back in that pool and you realize, nah, this pool's no longer for me. Like, that's murky and unfiltered water. Like, I want to come back over here in this pristine kind of turquoise blue water. That's like, why would I want to swim? It's like that Nemo thing, you know, when the pump stops in the tank and Nemo starts, you know, like that kind of thing. I don't want to swim in that tank anymore. Like, I want to be here. So that's the thing that always brings me back.
That's powerful, dude. And that's, yeah, I think you really hit the nail on the head. That to know, man, I tried going that way for a long time. I tried fucking going real far that way. And there's nothing at the bottom of that. And no matter how tough this feels, it's not going to feel as bad as that. And to have that, this can look different for everybody. And like you said, doesn't need to be the really big, you know, dark night to the soul. It doesn't need to be that. It can be different for everyone. And I feel like everyone will have some reference to that experience, and some might still be to come for people. But I think that's exactly the same for me. It's the most powerful thing kind of I can compare to, and like, I've been like, well, whatever this is, I know where that leads, and this is worth it. This has been a really great conversation, man. I've really enjoyed this, and I think especially there's so much in here for people that might have tried to meditate, might have tried to stick with something, but see the value of it, but haven't been able to persist for whatever reason. And I know this is something you help people with as well. So if someone wants to either hear more from you or reach out to you, where can they go to do that?
So flowstatescollective.com is our website, Flow States, so collective, and on Instagram at the Meditation Mentor is pretty much the two places you could reach me.
I'll leave links to that in the description down below. And man, I really appreciate you doing this. It's been great.